What level?
We will reconvene to the House Committee on Health Care, and I will start by giving you my sincerest apology for screwing this whole thing up. The Speaker was not attuned to our needs. She was attuned to the needs of the whole body. So we have to deal with that. Things get pretty confusing. A day like today means there is light at the end of a tunnel, and it's probably not a train. So I think we're getting ready to get out of here. We've had a few of these sessions already. They've been very, very helpful for us to get a sense of what's going on. And again, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you rearranging your schedule, you're screwing things up, coming down here, and then being made to wait almost an hour to get started, and it's very bad form. So let's see what we can do to make up for that with having some good information. And would you be so kind as to call the
first
witness?
The first, the 4 o'clock appointment, which is now the 4:45, is Family Care. Jeff Hetherington is the Chief Executive Officer presenting today.
Let's go.
Here comes some more.
Welcome, Jeff. And as weird as this to say, we actually have a little more leisure, except that you probably need to get back to Portland.
I am so sorry.
Where do you want to leave now?
Traffic. Sense of driving back to Portland at 4:45.
Traffic. It's snow. True. It's true. Especially with a giant crash on.
Some of us have
got to say, I'm used to speaking
I-5.
To a vast audience, but it looks sort of like half of a
half vast, right.
Okay. For the record, my name is Jeff Hetherington. I'm the president and CEO of Family Care Incorporated. You have our slide deck in front of you. I'll go through this as expeditiously as possible. Family Care is a Medicaid managed care company here in Oregon. We were founded in 1985 under an old House Bill 3013, which set up essentially a PPO-type operation under the Medicaid program. We transitioned to an Oregon Health Plan-type model, full HMO model, when the Oregon Health Plan came into effect in 1995, and then again transitioned as a CCO in 2012. So we've been around a long time, and there isn't one person left. Since 1985. In terms of our members, we serve Clackamas, Multnomah, Washington, and parts of Marion County. Membership now is approximately 130,000 clients, and more than 80,000 of those were added in 2014. And I'm going to talk about the growth a little bit more. As a percentage, Family Care has turned out to be the fastest growing CCO in the state, and that created its own issues, but we're pretty pleased that we weathered it. The one thing I will say is that every single one of our members has a primary care practitioner, and we come out on the low end in terms of complaints across the board, and also in terms of complaints for access. Pages 3 and 4 are our member demographics, and I will not spend any time on that. That's just for your information. As you can see, just from the grievances and complaint sheet, this comes from the Oregon Health Authority. We have one of the lower complaint levels in terms of client complaints. And that takes care of page 5. We'll go to our structure. Our structure is we are a 501c4 not-for-profit corporation. That means we're not a charitable organization, which is tax-free, but we are a tax-exempt organization. And you can see your local tax lawyer if you want to know more about that. The corporate structure is very simple and transparent. We have corporate members. The corporate members elect the board of directors and oversee the disposition of the assets if the company goes out of business. The board of directors does all of the rest of the governance of the company and sets all the policies for the company. We have no delegated entities or related entities that serve the Oregon Health Plan population, and I'll talk about that a little bit further because that's fairly important in understanding some of the finances of both Family Care and the others. Our key partners are, frankly, our providers. They've been the backbone of Family Care ever since we started. We have a very stable group, approximately 3,500 physicians, nurse practitioners, and mental health, behavioral health, addictions, and alcohol and addictions providers in that 3,500. We have both a community advisory committee and a medical advisory committee that are very active, and I'll talk about those in a minute. We also work closely with the other CCO in the Portland area on areas where it is beneficial to the client to do so. And our largest, I would say, success was in non-emergent transportation. You know, if there is one provider and one rule and one method of getting access to non-emergent transportation, that erases the confusion for the client, erases it for the providers, and frankly, erases it for the CCOs. We're also working together to talk about what kind of flexible benefits we'll provide throughout the Tri-County area. And working with the EDDY project, focusing on 911 high utilizers and emergency benefits. We have similar benefits, I would say probably exact same benefits for the transgender population. And we're both working with the Healthy Columbia Willamette Consortium on the community needs assessment. In terms of our community advisory committee, it's comprised of Family Care community members and providers. I won't go through the purposes because I'm sure you've heard them at least three different times. They're the same and pretty well specified by law. The council meets monthly with quarterly meetings open to the public. Based on the community health needs assessment, the council prioritizes services in its community health improvement plan, and we are focusing on transition-aged youth populations between the ages of 15 and 24. We have approximately 22,000 kids in that area, or in that demographic. We'll be focusing on access and engagement in care, specifically around mental health, substance abuse, and we should have put down here the homeless problem that a lot of these kids face, and working to support them in transitioning from child to adult health care systems, especially in the area of mental health services, and for youth existing in the foster care system. One of the things you may have seen in the news the last couple of days, and I'm sure you've heard in the building, is the problem of DHS having enough caseworkers to do regular home visits in foster homes. And what we have talked about in that particular area is we're going to have our own service coordinators working with the homeless youth, or excuse me, the foster kids, and making the monthly visits ourselves to talk with them about, you know, their health and their safety. So we're looking to, you know, help fill that gap. Having been a foster parent myself, I'm well aware of the fact that DHS is understaffed in that particular area.
It sort of always has been.
Well, and I was a foster parent in 1968, so that'll tell you something. Okay, in terms of, we were asked to talk about risk and profitability. Family Care, again, it's a single entity. We do not have any parent corporations, and we do not have any letters of credit or any creditors that would support us in terms of losses. So we bear all of the risks associated with the program. In terms of ROHP net revenue, Family Care had a net revenue of $73.5 million. Of that, I broke this down. $40 million of that was allocated into our reserve funds that are eventually going to be required as an insurance reserve. We're under a timeline to meet the DCBS requirements of $1 for every $10 in premium. By allocating that 40 into that, we now have about $60 million in reserves for the insurance requirements. And that was fairly important that we get that in place. And with our growth, which was quite expansive, we felt like we needed to fully fund that area and actually fund it for additional growth. And we have seen quite a bit of additional growth since the end of 2014. We also took $20 million of that and set it aside for grants to support community health programs. In terms of our current distribution, we've already distributed about $4.5 million of that to various and sundry, both bricks and mortar programs and service-type programs this year. And we'll be working on the rest of it as we go through the year. There's that one thing, we've been, quote, marked as a the most profitable health plan in the CCO world. First of all, I don't believe that that is an accurate portrayal of any of the finances. One of the reasons, and I did bring an extra sheet here to hand out, and I'll need a little help. And the helper knows who she is.
Oh, there she comes.
Talking about Cindy, but there you go.
It's her.
Family Care. Family Care is the only one of the 16 that does not have delegated entities or partners. And within, if you know anything about accounting practices, and some of you may and some of you may not, but when you have delegated partners, you are able legally and ethically to pass your profits around and through those other delegated entities. We don't have the ability to do that. We have reviewed the audited financial reports of all of the other CCOs, and if you read those reports back in the notes, it will reference the fact that they do, as a matter of their course of business, again, which is legal, and I'm not criticizing, it's just what they do, but they do pass their profitability down and through these other entities. The OHA does not capture those in the reports that the public gets or that you get. So there is, you know, there is probably a lot more profitability in the system than you think. The other side of that is that is not a bad thing if you're looking at 2014. We more than doubled our population in the first 6 months of the year. Those people don't start using services until after they're enrolled and after they get settled. You know, one of the problems that a number of us found, but almost 30% of them didn't even know they had coverage once they got it, which is a little odd, but that was a problem. We did not see the ramping up until September. And so in the insurance world, premium comes in immediately, expenses start to go up later. Now, what we're seeing is that those expenses are going up for 2015. And so if you use 2014 as a benchmark for any of us in terms of profitability, that would be something that the insurance world doesn't do. If you see it over year after year after year, that's a different matter. Now, I'll say something else, too. The OHA, and I would not criticize them for this, underestimated the number of people that were coming in. I think it was a surprise to all of us how many people came in. And so, you know, they got more than double than what we were expecting. And so, you know, the system will look a little cockamamie for 2014. I would hope that this thing that's going around, particularly about family care being the most profitable, you'd take a real jaundiced look at that, because there's a lot more profitability there. And I don't think it's a problem, because I think it's just a factor of timing rather than services being delivered. Our delivery system, as I said, we have about 3,500 primary care, 3,500 providers or primary care physicians, nurse practitioners, and specialty providers. And I've listed the various types. Point out that we rely primarily on private practice providers in our system. We always have. That's where we started. We also, however, use FQHCs, both the standalones and the county clinics in the Tri-County area. And in our behavioral health, since we were integrated starting in 1996, we had a foundation of private practice clinics rather than the county clinics, because the county clinics had their own mental health organization prior to the CCOs. But we do contract now with both the county and the private practice. We have all 8 DCOs in the Tri-County area, and I could spend about 25 minutes on that, but I won't.
Good.
And, there's too much time being spent on that. We have 2 hospital systems in our network, Legacy Hospital and Hospitals and Clinics, and the Providence Health Systems. The other hospitals have not chosen to contract with us, but they do accept our patients. I was asked to talk about financial incentives to transform the delivery system. One of the things we did early on is we raised our primary care reimbursements considerably. If you don't understand the RBRVS system, at least you can understand the spread here. The conversion factor, which is the constant times a formula that is generally paid by the CCOs, ranges from about $35 as a conversion system up to maybe $40, $41. We raised ours in 2012 to $50, and in 2014 we raised it to $65. Now, 65 is the level that the commercial payers are paying. The interesting thing about that is our actual cost, our net cost in that, was close to 0.1% in terms of increase. Sorry. It was close to 0.1% increase. In other words, it was extremely small. And where we saw the savings is exactly where 40 years worth of literature will tell you the savings are. You open up the access, your emergency department rates go down, your referrals to specialists go down, and your referrals for testing go down. And, you know, research has been there for years, and so we just decided to believe it and to see how it works. Now, what the real point of raising primary care reimbursement is because primary care is a knowledge-based service. You pay for time. You do not pay for procedures to primary care doctors. And if you don't pay for the time, you're not going to get it. That's the bottom case. I'll move faster.
We do have a little room today, so
yeah.
You could take maybe 10 minutes more and then leave this room.
Yeah, I think I can do that. We found the one kink in what we were doing was the knowledge-based specialists had their nose out of joint, and so we raised the knowledge-based specialty services up to the $65 level also. And what we've found is access for all of our clients has improved tremendously. And it's not in terms of can they get an appointment, but it is the time. They're getting more and better quality time with their providers, which is what we expected. We also provide quality bonuses on top of those. Our quality pool actually tripled in 2014. And on top of that, we offer shared savings if there is additional money on top of the quality bonuses. We are working to provide incentive payments to FQHCs. If we raise their reimbursement, they say, well, that doesn't help us because it just cuts our wraparound funds. So we are working with them to provide funding that does not count against their wraparound funding. We are working right now with the Women's Health Alliance to develop quality incentive programs for obstetricians, trying to get at the issue of early pregnancy care and also a consistent pregnancy care, because this population has a tendency to be slow getting into the doctor and not very diligent about seeing them when they need to. And our final, it's not our last thing. We've been working rather diligently on trying to restructure the primary care payments for the addictions and mental health area. The persistent mentally ill, the crisis people, that's pretty well settled. But there are, again, mental health is a time-based service, and it's completely underpaid. We are moving to a population health model. I will not spend a lot of time on that. If people want to ask questions on page 11, you can do that. I do want to spend some time on integration of services. As I mentioned, Family Care has had an integrated physical and mental health program since 1996. In 1996, we actually had dental also, but there was a little political decision to make dental a separate area. And that's all the time I'll spend on that. One of the things we did was we decided that that a siloed insurance operation did not meet an integrated model on the provider side. So we have changed our entire internal structure and taking all of the areas what you would normally think of as in an insurance office, which is your customer service, your navigators, your claims, referral and auths, case managers, care managers, behavioral health, and so on. And we have merged them into teams. So each team has all of the specialists in that team from those various areas. We're heavy on the navigators because that's where most of the calls come in. But we have behavioralists, we have the referral and all that. That each team, which we call a fully integrated service team, that team then is assigned to a special particular group of physicians and their patients. So what happens is it's a one-and-done system going in and going out. Now, the response by the providers, I can go through this in detail, but I won't. And you'll see how we call them ports, how they are integrated. The response from the providers has been extremely enthusiastic. One of the ways insurance companies spend time, the doctor's time, is by keeping him on the phone or making him call time after time. With this one-and-done system, it's been extremely well-received in the process. And frankly, the clients get as much service because that team gets to know the high flyers, whether they're chronic ill or whatever. It's the relationship between our team and the providers and the patients, which is frankly enhanced in that whole process. On page 7, you got some ideas of how we have organized the ports in the main. However, on page 18, we're doing something in our cultural competence area. Cultural competence is one of those things that everybody talks about, and with being a little inappropriate, we're not going to take a bunch of white male providers and turn them into culturally competent people in the various ethnic groups or other groups. That just isn't going to happen. What we are doing, however, is that we are teaming up with the various ethnic groups that we have, particularly our large ones first, and the Asian Health and Service Center and the Asian community. We have taken some of their providers and some of their navigators that they have within their system. We have trained them on our system. And so when we get an Asian client, then they are assigned to that particular port, which has both some family care internal people and some Asian health service centers.
You've used 35 of your 20 minutes, and I think these folks may have a question or two that I'd like to ask you. Okay, Guy,
thank you for starting with me. I always have questions. I'll try to keep it really short because thank you for staying so late today.
Okay. We'll take about 10 minutes.
I would have loved to have heard more about your population-based services, so I'm sorry you skipped over that, but I recognize the time constraint, so maybe another time because I'm passionate about that. You also skipped over dental, and I'm curious, at least a small piece of the question is, did you increase your provider rates for dentists and hygienists? We know that's such an access issue. Maybe less so in the metropolitan area, but it's been a big issue across the state.
I'll probably give you an answer you won't like, but we don't have much control over dental. Mm-hmm. We do pay them, and they are, quote, part of our system. But the DCOs, the way they're set up in the law, are independent agencies, and they pay attention to us when they want to. Now, I'm not criticizing them, but we don't have the ability to go in like we do with mental health and physical health and start defining, you know, access times and so on within the contracts unless they want to sign those. And there has been a reluctance for them to meet the kind of criteria we'd like them to meet.
Can I follow up on that?
Yes, please.
Because my understanding is that there actually are prescribed, you know, periods. It's 24 hours for emergency, two weeks for urgent care, and 8 to 12 weeks are community standard for routine care. And I thought that that was what the CCO-DCO contract was.
Well, it's in there.
It's in there. You just don't have a lot of control. Okay. And then I just wondered.
We are able, for instance, with our mental and physical health providers, we are able to do things with their contract up to and including releasing them from their contract. If they don't meet those standards in terms of what the Oregon law says, we have to contract with all 8 DCOs, uh-huh, no matter what. Now, again, they're pretty good. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't say that they're not good, but in terms of ramping up to the high quality we'd like to see, we don't have that ability yet.
Okay. I have one more question, but I'll just see if we have time later.
Anybody else? Do not.
Oh, Rep. Bueller does.
Representative Bueller.
Thank you, Chair.
I have
Hanley.
Two questions.
Jeff, thanks for your presentation, and I'll forgive you for not classifying orthopedics as a knowledge-based specialist.
You can be limited to 65. You might be limited to 65.
If the shoe fits.
Yeah.
Tell me about your relationship with providers through this process.
Well, we were started by a group of providers, almost like an IPA, except it wasn't an IPA model. And I come from a provider association in my previous life. And we have always treated our providers as actually being the first customer in the organization. The reason for that is that we have traditionally been a discount payer. And if you're a discount payer and you also hassle the providers, you don't have the access to the members. That's just the way, you know, human behavior works. So our relationship with our providers is high. We do a regular assessment, independent poll with them, and our scores were around 93% a year ago in terms of their satisfaction with our services. Claims is always a problem. But in terms of, you know, we get a very friendly relationship, and we work hard at it. Unlike particularly other areas of the insurance world, we have representatives. Sometimes we have our own navigators in their offices 3 days a week working with them. Those are with some of our larger providers. All of our providers get at least a quarterly visit from us checking up on, you know, what issues they have and you know, how are they following our services. So we work diligently on having a good relationship with them.
Jeff, I have two simple questions. I'll ask them both.
Okay.
First question, I think you've had brilliant insight into getting things moving by offering to pay more money to primary care doctors. It obviously made a huge difference, and it was important. But downstream, if we're going to keep the costs under control in a sustainable way, we have to do something. I assume we have to do something other than simply paying more to physicians to get them to see your patients. So the first question is, downstream, do you see some innovative ways to keep the cost increase in some sustainable way?
Well, I think two of it is...
I'll tell you the second question,
yeah,
too, which is... You've got to talk to us about the lawsuit, obviously.
The issue with regard to keeping costs down, on the physician side, if you have a robust primary care network and you pay them for doing all the services they can provide, it does keep your specialty costs down. And the referrals to specialists are more on point. They're not just dumping up, which is what happens when you have lower payments in your primary care area. In terms of overall cost of health care, my opinion is you are going to have to pay attention to the two largest areas of inflation. One is hospital costs, which keep going up. Now, Oregon has a fairly good control over it, with the caveat that we tie it to Medicare rates. And what CMS has done is they have continually raised the rates. Now, they say it's a 3.25% average, but the truth of the matter is that covers all of the services that are offered, but it's the big ones that get the huge increase. And I think it was 2012 when OBG rates for CMS went up by 6%. And so when you have those kinds of things driven by the feds, it's a little hard. The other is pharmaceuticals. And pharmaceuticals, are going up at about 18% a year. I don't know if anybody else has talked about this, but the generic drugs are now almost equal to the brand name drugs.
We're going to try and look at that over the interim.
Yeah, and what the pharmaceuticals are doing is say, well, then why would you buy the generic when you can buy the brand name drug at the same price? Now, the reason why they want to do that, of course, is they've got a patent on the brand name drug, and they don't have to fight with competitors in the generic field. And the consolidation of the pharmacies, you're down to five big ones and a few fairly greedy small ones. It's a problem. And Sovaldi, everybody's talking about, but...
There's a bigger one right down the line.
Right down the line, yeah. And we cannot, as a whole state, the whole population cannot sustain those kinds of cures.
A brief comment on the lawsuit.
Our issue and the reason why we filed the lawsuit is on two short grounds. Number one is breach of contract. It is within the rules of OHA that they, and within the contract where they have to give us notice on change of rates. They have to give us notice on the contracts. They broke both of those rules themselves. The most egregious was when they handed us our contracts on December 24th at 3 o'clock, and then the entire upper echelon went on vacation until January the 5th. We had no way of negotiating. We had no way of getting any response to anything within that contract. The bigger problem for family care is in the rate structure, and this may get a little technical, but the rate structure, the governor promised all of the CCOs a 3.4% increase in their rates. And now it was without qualification that promise kept being made. We were all surprised that did not apply to the expansion population. And the expansion population then was carved out, and we're not sure what happened because the OHA will not tell us what they did. What we do know is there is a range of rates within that expansion population that is 70% goes up to 70% with different CCOs. So one CCO may have, you know, a $30 pay, and the other has a $70 pay or a $100 pay. It makes no sense. As one of our colleagues said, if someone had handed me this sheet of paper with the rates on, I would have handed it back and said, do it again. The bigger question is, in the Portland area, is that health share and family care ended up with essentially the same amount of expansion people. Health share had a few more than we did, but not enough to be really significant. The difference in rates for that expansion population between the two of us is 11%. And family care ended up at the bottom of the barrel. We got our rates cut by 9.2%. And there was only...
For the record, and let me say for the record, I have never heard the promise that each was given a promise of 3.4% increase. It was that the total population was to have a 3.4% increase, and then the individual plans were to be risk adjusted inside that 3.4%.
That may have been what you heard, but that is not what the governor himself was telling the plans. And I can bring the plans down here one by one to talk to you about that.
We'll have another discussion on that. I think that's going to be up, but I just wanted to put on the record that I don't agree with it, that that was ever the deal. Jeff, we need to switch off now.
That's fine.
You're obviously having fun and doing a good job, and we have some questions, and we'll have a chance to raise those as we go along, but we really appreciate you being here to talk
to us. All right. It's always a pleasure to stay after
good
five.
It's very thorough.
Sandy, would you please call our next trends?
Yes. Health Share of Oregon, Janet Meyer, CEO.
And another apology. I can't hand out enough apologies today.
Well, thank you, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. I did time my presentation. It was 18 minutes. I may be able to skip a few slides. So
no, 18 minutes. 18 minutes would be wonderful.
I hate to stand between you all and dinner. And, you know.
Oh, 18 minutes would be just great. Give us a chance to ask a couple of questions.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Janet Meyer, and I am the CEO of HealthShare of Oregon, and I want to thank you for this opportunity today. If you go to the first slide, you'll see that our service area is Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington County. As of April, our enrollment is about 251,000 people. That's a 21% increase from last year. And from 2 years ago, that's a 51% increase. So far, we believe our system, our delivery system, has been able to absorb this new population. We very closely and vigorously monitor access and capacity. So far, it looks like the expansion population is getting the equal access that the previous population was getting. I would say there was some problems in mental health. The assessments were getting done, the treatment was delayed, but that has since closed. That gap has closed. So we're very pleased to see that our capacity and access analysis is showing that we're able to give the access to these new enrollees. And we're not seeing higher ED utilization in this new population. We are not seeing any evidence that this is a very sick population. So far, they're tracking pretty much the way we had anticipated it actuarially. The change in our member mix from being predominantly kids and pregnant women to predominantly adults, that's a big change for Medicaid. Medicaid always did kids and pregnant women. Now we're dealing with a different population mix. So that has been an exciting new opportunity, and we continue to not lose sight of the kids and the pregnant women, because if we lose sight of them, they will become the next generation of high utilizers, and we don't want to see that. I would point out that we continue to struggle with incomplete data from the Oregon Health Authority as it relates to our members' language preferences and race and ethnicity. So 26% of our enrollees, we do not know what their language preference is. Makes it very difficult to effectively communicate with that population. 36% of our enrollees, we do not know their race or ethnicity. It's simply not available. So while we work very hard on eliminating disparities and on being culturally responsive, this lack of information is causing us some struggles. Structure and governance, you can read what's on the slide. I will tell you that CCOs are supposed to reflect the communities in which they operate. Our service area is complicated. We're not Roseburg. right? We have 17 hospitals. We have three counties that operate and tens of thousands of providers in our service area. So our CCO, while it may not look like the other CCOs, we believe it reflects our founders' intentions and it reflects the complexity of the market that we operate in. We are a collaborative. It started out with 5 fully capitated physical health plans, 3 mental health plans, and 8 dental plans. All but one of those organizations stayed with the collaborative and launched what became HealthShare. I won't go into what a collective impact model is. I'm sure you are familiar with that model. I would say there was no appetite on the part of our board to build a big health insurance company. Health insurance plans are not going to transform healthcare. They never have. That's not what they're designed to do. What our board wanted to do was to create something different, something transformational. It might have been actually easier to just consolidate all of our partners, and so we could look like what other people believe a CCO should look like, but we believe that what is transformative is to create something entirely new, and that's what HealthShare represents. In addition on our structure and governance, it's very simple. We're a private nonprofit corporation with an IRS designation as a tax-exempt charitable organization. Our board composition meets and in many instances exceeds the legislative requirements. So, for example, we're required to have mental health and addictions, mental health or addictions. HealthShare requires both. We're required to have a primary care physician or nurse practitioner. HealthShare requires both. So we have gone above and beyond. We do not have a holding company. Our board is not a report-out board. It is a 20-member governing board in the fullest sense. Each member has an equal vote. There's no weighting of votes based on status as a founding organization, the size of the entity, or whatever. Our board minutes are available to the public upon request. And I'm very lucky. I have a very wonderful, talented, and dedicated board. So I was asked to talk about our key partners. I hesitate to talk about key partners because of the breadth of our provider network, but our founding organizations are listed on the next slide. Our physical health plan partners, people really are curious about why we have 4 physical health plan partners. Each of our physical health plan partners have unique primary care panels. There's not overlap between our partners. So they're each operating a proprietary primary care network that is accountable for physical health and accountable for the assigned population. We're also very successfully working with community providers, social service organizations, Healthy Columbia Willamette, that we work on our community health needs assessment, and other dental plan partners, et cetera. In regards to our Community Advisory Council, we actually sat our Community Advisory Council before we sat our board. We got a little excited. We got a little ahead of ourselves there. So we sat our Community Advisory Council in July, and our board was actually sat in August. It's been tremendously enjoyable, and it's been tremendously difficult work. It has really enhanced my life professionally and personally, and the lives of our staff. Our council members are hardworking, and they are unafraid. It's one of the best parts of my job. It's one of the hardest parts of my job. I have been privileged to attend all but one Community Advisory Council meeting. They meet once a month for half of a day, and all of our sessions are public. They really are wonderful. They lead with their arms and their hearts wide open, and with the best interests of our members front and center all the time. So it's been very, very challenging, but very rewarding at the same time. They did develop our community health improvement plan based on the joint needs assessment and focused on behavioral health and chronic disease related to nutrition and physical activity. We've been working diligently for a year on implementing our community health improvement plan, and we are just now completing our evaluation and will be reported to our board at the meeting next week and to the OHA later this month. So you can stay tuned and see how all the CCOs are doing on our one-year community health improvement plans. Regarding risk and profitability, like all CCOs, HealthShare subcapitates organizations who are accountable for an assigned population. That is a given in the CCO world. So everybody has some subcapitated arrangements. We have them. We contract with reputable organizations who can manage the risk, both clinically and financially. We meet all the requirements for restricted reserves and net worth, and HealthShare is accountable for the risk of the population that's been assigned to us at the end of the day. The model is based on supporting and established provider networks in our community. The next page shows you how we divvy up the money, if you will. shows which partners get how much. You can see that Care Oregon is a large partner of ours, but Providence and Kaiser are also quite significant, as well as Tuolumne and our counties. Some of those smaller pies, they represent a ton of people, but the premium gets really small when you get to dental and when you get to mental health. So you go from a $250 premium to a $20 premium. So the pie gets a little distorted in that regard. But don't misunderstand, those smaller slices of the pie are dealing with the same number of enrollees. In terms of risk and profitability, you know, we were asked about this, and CCO profitability is really difficult to measure across CCOs. They're not all the same. They're not all nonprofits. There's different organizational ownership and shareholder relationships. But at the end of the day, the OHA does not collect data from CCOs in a uniform manner. So it's very hard to compare when we're not asked to report in a uniform manner. One thing I would tell you is that HealthShare has established a minimum medical loss ratio for all of our partners. That's the ratio of premiums that are spent on services. Each type of service has a different target, but we aim for an aggregate of 92%. If one of our partners is not spending the targeted amount on services to members, we require them to use those funds to either invest in expansion of the network capacity, increase payments to providers, or increase reserves to the maximum allowed by the board policy. So we work very hard at HealthShare not to trap equity in our partner organizations and to make sure the money is moving on out the door. Our corporate retained earnings in 2014 was 1.1% of premium, which is about $15 million. So in terms of transformation, fundamental changes to the way care is delivered, I would say that we've developed one of the best models for data analytics and reporting. We've been very successful with our partners in that regard. We were lucky to have a Health Commons project that was funded by the federal government that allowed us to really kind of play in the sandbox of transformation. That funding is ending on June 30th. I'd be happy to talk about some of the things we learned from that initiative. We've also focused on the changes to the financing of healthcare. I discussed our global budget and our actuarial policies about medical loss targets. That's one of the ways we've approached transforming the way we pay. The other is outpatient case rates for mental health. It's not the biggest money in mental health, but it touches the most patients in mental health. So outpatient mental health is a high volume service. And so we've moved from a fee-for-service model to a case rate model. That took 2 years to make that change. So we didn't want to destabilize the network while we were making the change. But we're up and running on that. That's a treat-to-target model. So we think that's going to be beneficial. Integrating physical, mental, substance use disorders, that's really hard work. We've done some great clinical integration with Project Nurture, which provides midwife services in Addictions Residential. We have a really innovative provider community in our service area, and many of our mental health providers and physical health providers are innovating in clinical integration without financial integration. And I will be honest, we've made less progress in financial integration for mental health, addictions, and physical health. We take the role of the counties as a local mental health authority very serious. We think it's irresponsible to do anything that would destabilize the safety net that they've created for us, and we know that they commit significant county funds to our safety net, and we really need to honor that relationship and that role. So we do proceed with caution. I think we're getting close to something that's going to be very transformational, and we'll be excited to share it with you next year, but I think we're getting there. Again, we really believe that we need to honor that relationship and move with caution. Our quality metrics, we're on track to meet 15 of the 17 metrics for this year, including two that we missed last year. Last year, I think we felt like we were teaching to the test when it came to quality metrics. We got 100% of the funds, but it didn't really feel like we were really doing what we needed to do. This year, I think we made a significant commitment to our providers, our plan partners, and our staff led that effort. And this year, we didn't just barely meet the targets. We blew through our targets. And so we see greater return on our investments by being a little more systematic in our attempts. Our three metrics for worst performance, I think, are very common, and I won't spend a lot of time on them because I think all the CCOs are landing on the same metrics that are hard. One is screening, brief intervention, and referral to treatment. That's been a heavy lift. We saw great progress this year. It's going to get more challenging next year because the age dropped to the adolescent population. The other metric that we've struggled with was adolescent well-child visits. Anybody that's been a parent of an adolescent, either currently or in the past, is probably still in PTSD, but it's a very challenging population to engage.
Really?
Yes.
About 35 years later, it just seems all sweet.
But you're surrounded by two parents here who are remind you all the time.
Yes.
Sorry, guys. That's a tough crowd to work with, and we're working very hard on our adolescent well visits. And the last one, and I think the most heartbreaking one to us, was the assessments for our members in DHS custody, so the kiddos in foster care. I tell our staff, if we can't do right by this population, we ought to just pack our bags and go home, because this is some of the most vulnerable people in our membership, and we really ought to be doing great work with them. I think we've set up a system. I think we've had challenges. I think we've surmounted them, and we're going to see great effects from our efforts this year. How'd I do?
Good. Mm-hmm. It's a good presentation.
I'm happy to take any questions.
Okay. You look at me.
Yeah.
Well, now you can have carte blanche because I never have any questions. So.
I'll start off with a comment. You're the fourth one today, and it's been really exciting to hear about the progress that each of the CCOs are making. And one of the things that you didn't touch on, but I looked at while you were talking, was your website, which is phenomenal.
Thank you.
First of all, you have Arabic, Chinese, Vietnamese, and I checked out some of the pages. Like, even the minutes for your Community Advisory Council meetings are translated into Chinese, mm-hmm. Arabic, et cetera. So it's very, very impressive.
I reviewed the Arabic, and I don't think they got it right.
Shwaya shwayabes.
Okay.
And also the Community Advisory Council. Yeah. I've been asking a lot about that today, and so you have a lot of great information about not just minutes, but bios and things like that. There's so many things that I could ask about, and so I'm not even sure where to start. So some of the things that were just brought up by the previous panel, by Jeff, was the challenge of working with the dental organizations. And there's a million things we could ask about, but I wonder if you could address that, how that's gone for you, what suggestions you might have about how we can smooth the way.
Thank you, Representative or Chair Greenlich and Representative Kenny Geyer. I will say that it's been quite an interesting tour of duty with the dental partners. We had 8 dental plans in our market. HealthShare doesn't believe anything is good enough, so we went with 9 dental plans because Kaiser elected to join Medicaid Dental when we took the dental benefit in, which was wonderful. So we have 9 dental partners, and I think the first year it was pretty awkward and we were learning how to date each other, and I think now we're settling into a relationship. I do think that the joint metric really helps because it gives us something intentional and meaningful to work with our partners, the sealant metric. And the foster kids metric now includes dental assessment. So I think that's really going to be a little bit of a game changer. I will tell you, one of HealthShare's fundamental values is transparency. And we get really comfortable being uncomfortable at HealthShare because we have a high degree of transparency. And I think our dental partners have been a little surprised at how transparent we are in terms of, here's the data, here's how you profile, what are we going to do to improve preventive, dental in adults. So we've worked with them in a very transparent manner, and as they've learned our style, I think we've learned new ways to have conversations. So I'm hopeful, but I'm an optimist. So
I follow up with another area, pharmacy, and this is something I'd wanted to ask Jeff because you had it listed also, the PBMs, the formulary, the rates going up, the challenge of wanting to treat HIV, Hep C with Sovaldi, and wanting to make sure that we don't just worry about the short-term costs because the long-term costs if we don't treat that. So how are you approaching the whole?
Thank you, Chair Greenlich, Representative Kenny Geyer. We take a very collaborative approach, and we actually leverage the subspecialist in our network to advise us on this. In the case of Sovaldi, we convened all the leading hepatologists in the Tri-County area to develop some clinical protocols for us, and it was really done with their genius behind it. It was not an insurance guideline, it was a clinical guideline. And in fact, our clinical guideline ended up being the one that the state adopted for Sovaldi. So we're trying to take that model and continue to leverage it with some of the other tricky to treat conditions and high cost drugs. You know, it really is the providers who are the expert in this. And in our experience, our providers are very reasonable and understanding about financial realities, and they're also very clear-eyed about clinical benefits of treatment. So, you know, we need to trust that.
Thank you.
Let me ask a question, and it's the same question I'm asking everybody. I believe if we stick to the, however we define it, Zip and I'll have that discussion, it's 3.4% increase for the whole population over time, off into the future. We can't make that sustainable and deliver care the way we're delivering it now. What sort of hope do you see for the future that we're somehow really changing the production function for healthcare with where we're moving forward?
Well, thank you, Chair Greenlit. I actually, I believe that we are making some progress. I think the first year or so when we started, we were all felt like we were drinking from a fire hose and just trying to survive every day. And now I think we've settled in and are able to do some more intentional investments. I think we need to look at alternate service providers, including traditional health workers in the EMS system. So an example is that we have placed a nurse in the probation, in the parole office at Multnomah County in order to catch the guests on their way out of the jail before they get too far away so we can get them connected to primary care. That's proven to be very beneficial in terms of particularly medication management. We placed a nurse practitioner in the Bud Clark Commons, which is a housing first organization. That means that housing unit has active drug users in residence. There was a lot of wound care and skin issues going on in that facility. We placed a nurse practitioner in there. We demonstrated a return on investment, and we developed a sustainable business model. So those are the kinds of things you have to think very differently with our population. You know, we always say we swim in the deep end of the pool, and we do, but we also can't forget about those kids that are out there. So, you know, we're also looking at, we've just retained the Reach Out and Read organization to do an assessment for us on our pediatric engagement in the Reach Out and Read program, which is a program that gives books to kids when they come in for their well-child visits. And we know that kindergarten readiness has a direct correlation to future health status. We can track it through people's lives. I'm sure you've spoke with Dr. Labby about, you know, the impact of that. So we're doing a number of things, but they're different kinds of things, and they're a little harder to get your hands around. Our real challenge is not to do a science project, but to identify an opportunity and to figure out what a sustainable business model is. If there's a return on investment, we need to figure out the business model that will sustain it. It can't be fee-for-service, but it has to be something that we can connect back to our clients and to improved outcomes.
And that leads me to ask about your subcapitation model.
Uh-huh.
Talk a little bit about the variety. How tight are those subcapitation models, and how is that working?
Well, I think it goes back to our commitment to transparency and accountability. There's a high degree of accountability. This is not a situation where we give the money and we say, go forth and do good work. Give us a call when you're done. This is a very active and interactive group of healthcare leaders who are serving a population in a proprietary primary care network. We have an extensive compliance and delegation oversight, and we actually do tell the providers when they're not doing things right, and it can be difficult and awkward. But we believe that's part of our role, and we really look at that as part of our role as a convener and a collaborator and something of a regional health authority over our partners.
Well, who tells them, with your unique model, if a group of province providers are not doing it right, do you tell them, or does mm-hmm. Providence tell them?
No, we tell them. Yeah. Providence is a great example because they're doing a total cost of care model with their Providence Medical Group, and they're really having some extremely good outcomes, allowing them to experiment within their system. We're also fortunate to work with Kaiser, and Kaiser is one of our easiest partners to work with. They bring a lot of knowledge to the table, and they're very open.
I was delighted to hear you mention the Kaiser Dental Program, which began as a poverty medical care.
Really?
Yeah, I started in 1968 for an OEO Neighborhood Health Center project we had, and that's the beginning of it with this.
I didn't know that.
That's cool.
We celebrated the 40th anniversary and started a Mitch Greenlick Fellowship or something.
Through the Northwest Health Foundation.
Well, Chair Greenlick, thank you. We were pleased to get Kaiser.
He's all over the place.
He's a new one. Janet and Jeff, thank you so much for being here. What you're doing you. Is very, very important to us and to the state. We'll have lots of questions about things as we go on. How about this? How about that? But we're very much committed to getting a sort of baseline information about all 16 of you. And it's been a very exciting time, a very exciting ride.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your patience again. One last apology. No. That's all you get. I'm really sorry things got so messed up. We are adjourned. Sorry things got so messed up.